Let's continue. So, what can you do with behavioral psychology besides get baboons addicted to smack? Well, let's see, shall we? Hero rats, for example. We can make heroic rats. This is a picture of a African giant couched rat, the Gambian rat. They are about, yay big, stuff like that. Cute little buggers. Give them banana, they will be your friend. Okay, banana, peanuts, all kinds of things. So what's cool about this is actually an organization called Hero Rats, or more technically, APOPO, A-P-O-P-O, APOPO, working out of, based out of Mozambique, although they're working in a number of areas in Central Africa. What the organizers have done is they have taken the Gambian pouched rat and trained these rats to be able to detect landmines and tuberculosis. Different rats. Some rats are landmine detectors, others are tuberculosis detectors. Okay? And to do this, they utilize both classical and operant conditioning processes, principles. Okay, why use the giant pouched rats? Well, first thing here is they're indigenous to Africa, so they're used to, they're native to the area, the heat, the dryness in areas. The conditions are what they are used to. A lot of bomb detection, in fact, actually the most commonly used animal for bomb detection are dogs. Your typical German Shepherd or whatnot is actually not very well suited for African climates. Okay, there are African dogs. Those can be used. But so there's a plus for the rat. They can live for about 8 years in captivity, almost as long as many of the larger-bodied, larger-sized dogs. They are big, maybe up to 1.5 to 2 kilos of rat, but they're not what I'm going to call kaboom big. Typically takes between, depending on things, between 5 to 10 kilos of pressure to set off a landmine. If the bomb-sniffing dog goofs and steps on the mine, he's going to go and possibly take his handler with him, or her handler with him. Rats at under 2 kilos, they can, like, dance on the mine and it won't go off, okay? So much safer in that respect. As well, I mean, if the dog steps on a mine and it blows up, you've lost all of the investment, like over a year's investment in the dog, and for just training, as well as, you know, all the years of experience perhaps the dog's had. So in this sense, they're much better. They're quite calm. If you raise them from pups, they're very easily handled. Matter of fact, the trainers frequently just walk around, the handlers, the people that work with them, just walk around carrying the rat or the rat perched on their shoulder and sorts of things. Dogs tend to form strong attachments with a person, becomes their person. Rats, not so much, actually. So if, I mean, the rats usually have a particular handler, the one who has done most of the training with the rat. But if the particular handler is off at a conference or is sick or is at a wedding or something else, and somebody else has to take, you know, take that rat, and work with it. As long as the other person's got banana and peanuts, the rat's pretty much cool with that. Whereas dogs are like, oh, who are you? I don't know you. I work with Bob. You don't smell like Bob. I've got kibble. Yeah, but you're not Bob. Bob has the best kibble. It's the same kibble. I'm kind of freaked out about this. Whereas the rats are like, show me the banana. Okay, we're good. I guess that makes him seem a little bit easy. But really, they're just very pragmatic about getting the food. I will work, but only for banana and peanuts. They don't get bored easily, right? They're willing to do stunningly repetitive tasks for hours and hours and hours, again, as long as there's a food payoff in it. Whereas dogs, after a few hours of, like, sniffing for bombs, like, okay, let's go play Frisbee. You know, throw a stick in a minefield, not a good idea. All right? So they get bored. They just, you know, so dogs may only be willing to work at this for sort of thing for a few hours before they start getting bored, get distracted, make mistakes. Other thing, very quick to train. You can get a rat into the field in 8 to 12 months. Usually takes well over a year to do this with a dog. Also a lot less expensive in terms of the amount of food you have to give them, the amount of housing it takes, all these things. So there's some real perks there. You can see here this one's wearing little harnesses, little ferret harnesses. Walk your rat on a leash sort of thing. I started work in Mozambique. Basically what happened, the founder of Apopo, Dutch, came out of Holland. As a kid, he raised rodents, rats, hamsters, guinea pigs, and he'd sell rodents to pet stores. So basically he was a supplier of pet stores in Holland. And as an adult, he said, what can I do that combines my love of rodents with something that's philanthropic, that can actually help people? He heard about he read about a program where some American researchers were training gerbils to try to detect bombs in suitcases, in planes, so at airports. And he said, I can do that with rats. I think I can do that with rats. And sure enough, was able to do this. To give you some idea here, but why did they pick these things to get involved in? In Mozambique alone, there's over 500,000 landmines that were left after the cessation of hostilities. Now, a single rat can cover about 200 square meters, can clear about 200 square meters. Well, sorry, it can identify. I shouldn't say clear, because that takes the other people to come in with the trucks and the suits and the bomb removal, but can identify where ordnance is and cover about 200 meters in 1 hour. That's the same as 2 days' work for a person, just a person that's doing this, working with metal detectors and other things to find the explosives. It's a lot faster than dogs as well. So stunningly rapid. In 2006, 2007, for example, just operating in a fairly localized area around three villages, they cleared over 73,000 square meters of ordnance. This was a direct benefit to 266 families that lived in these three villages. So more like, you know, 1,000 plus people right there. And so big benefit. They are expanding. So initially out of Mozambique, then down into Tanzania and other parts of Africa as well. They're starting to work in these areas to clear ordnance. The second one is tuberculosis, and this is a big problem. Tuberculosis is treatable, but it needs to be detected, to be treated. The traditional way to do this is microscopy. Well, sorry, I shouldn't say traditional. The 20th century way of detecting is through microscopy. So you take saliva samples and look at them under the microscope. The way the rats do it is by learning the scent of tuberculosis. We don't exactly know what tuberculosis smells like, but just through classical conditioning processes, rats can learn to identify it. So they sniff it out in little samples. They're about 100 times faster than a human. Okay, so they can cover 40 samples in about 7 minutes. That's the equivalent of 2 days microscopy work for a person. That's huge. Okay. Tuberculosis is a big deal in other places, but in Africa as well, because you've got HIV, AIDS as well. If you have HIV, AIDS, and you get tuberculosis, you're pretty much just dead. The average person with tuberculosis, estimates suggest, will probably expose and infect about 15 people a year. So the sooner you can identify individuals that have tuberculosis, the sooner you can treat them. This is a big lifesaver. With the training, so what kind of training is actually being done here? At 5 weeks of age, that's another nice thing. Dogs, you know, for dogs, you're waiting until they're like maybe, you know, three months old to start. Start with rats at 5 weeks of age. You start with socialization and habituation training. So they just get used to being handled, they get used to being taken places, they're carried past generators that make weird humming noises. They're made to walk on wet grass, over pebbles. They get to ride in cars. I've got this mental image of like the rat hanging its head out the window of the cars and driving along. They get introduced to new people. The handlers just take their rats with them where they go. So this is habituation. It's reducing the fear response to novel stimuli. Then they move into classical conditioning. This is clicker training. So they use a standard click, click, to indicate when the rat should come back and get a reward, get a treat. Okay, so they go through standard classical conditioning. Then they move into operant learning. So this is the discrimination training phase. The rats are trained to scratch at a point, to scratch in the presence of a particular smell. Explosives, chemicals involved in explosives produce a particular odor. If the rat and the rats are exposed to various types of things, and if they respond in the presence of the smell of an explosive, they get rewarded. If they fail to respond, they don't. If they respond to something that's not explosive, they do not get rewarded. So we're doing a training process, a shaping process, right? Discriminative stimulus. This smell, in the presence of this smell, if you respond, you will get reinforced. Amazing thing here as well, of course, as with dogs, but also with rats, I mean, they can smell explosives through, you know, dirt. Okay? So very, very high sense of smell. Same sort of thing for the tuberculosis. You take samples that are known to have tuberculosis and samples that you know through microscopy do not have tuberculosis. If the rat scratches when in the presence of tuberculosis, it gets a little drink of banana smoothie. If it scratches with in presence of a sample that does not have tuberculosis, nothing. So you're conditioning here. So there's just a picture of clicker training. So you see the hand here is holding a little clicker, and the rat, they go through shaping, right? So the rat's turn, if the rat sort of orients towards you, is looking towards you, click, come over, get some food. If it's, you know, then looking a little bit away, click, if it comes over and get some food. And so what they're trying to do here in the case of the bomb, landmine detecting rats, is to bring them back so that they're out in the field in an area identifying mines. If they find something and start scratching, the human operator doesn't want to walk out there. They identify on a grid, on a map, where the rats identify, but you need to get the rat to come back to get its treat. Okay, so that's what the click does. They can hear it and comes running back to get the treat. In the case of tuberculosis, if it identifies it, I'll show you a little video that shows this how they do this. They got to run over to the side of the apparatus to get their banana smoothie. Okay, so there's clicker training, and there's the operant conditioning. So this is the tuberculosis setup here. So the samples, these little tiny petri dishes, are put under these little holes, so the rat can't get down into a dish filled with tuberculosis sample, but it can sniff, and if it scratches around the hole that's got a sample below it that has tuberculosis, then here's a click, and it runs over. So here's the holes there. This is, you know, a couple meters wide. It runs over, and it gets a little bit of banana smoothie from a syringe. This is actually a pretty young rat in this picture here. So it's going through training at this point. With the bomb, the landmine rats, they start out in these controlled areas, so they run a string across it. So the rats work in little sort of paths, so you can run a little string from one end of a field to another, and it's in a little harness, so it can move maybe 20 centimeters on either side of the string. They just go back and forth in a little sequence, like going up and down aisles in the supermarket, sniffing for bombs. Okay, so here they've got a sandbox area, a dirt area where they've buried a variety of things here. Some of these are deactivated, actual explosives. Others are distractors. If the rat scratches over top of an area that holds a deactivated landmine, then gets reinforced. And here, you know, they take it out in the field. And again, they go through a successive approximation. So in the field, this is actually the explosive from a landmine, no fuse in it, so it's just lying on the ground. If the rats come up and sniffs it here, then they'll bury it, and so on. So now they're working from a nice shifting from moving from a nice, easy, sandy patch here in a controlled room out to someplace in the field where there's grass and prickly things and all kinds of distractors out there. Okay, so there's your field training for the landmine detection. The landmine detecting rats go through exactly the same certification process as dogs do. So to be certified as a bomb sniffing dog, you've got to go through a test. It's a blind test where the certification process has landmines buried out in the field, and the dog has to be able to find deactivated. The rats go through exactly the same testing, and the certification process for dogs has been in place for a couple of decades there, so they're doing exactly the same thing. So, you know, here we have a dog that's going to go through a certification testing, so there's the handler for the dog, and, well, here's the handler for the rat. The dog's just, I imagine what's going on through the dog's mind at this point. It's like, you're a funny-looking dog. Are you a poodle? Or can I eat you? Or something like that. But go through exactly the same testing. So out in the field, this is what they use. They essentially use like a wagon wheel without the rim on the wheel. So you can see that there's a cord here that runs along. So all they do is they've got a field they have to clear. They set this little wagon wheel down with all the spokes. The rat runs from one side down. There's another wheel at the other side, spoke or a hubless wheel. So it runs from one end to the other. If it doesn't detect anything, they just bloop, roll the wheel, the spokes, one more over. That moves it about 30 centimeters along. Zoop, rat runs back the other way. So usually two people. With a small sort of set, you can do one person working this. But usually two people just boop, roll it, boop, roll it. Rat just zoop, 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 back and forth. Clears the area. Scratches. You can see that this has got, the bar here has got white and black markings so they can get the distance. So if the rat scratches someplace, they can note down, you know, at such and such a position in the field, the rat scratched, then they send back in the disposal team to actually check it and see what, if anything, is there. So here we go. The rat is now fully certified out in the field. We've got a rat right out there, and there's their truck. The human operators are, you know, wearing some bomb protection gear. And there goes the rat. Okay? The handlers get very attached to the rats, as it turns out. Just like dog handlers do. This is the fellow, Bart Wietjens, who founded Apopo. So there he is with a hero rat. So a couple of videos here. Those are the little petri dishes with samples. Yeah, there's the clicker. Off he goes. There's the banana smoothie. It's like, do I get any more? No. Back to work. Really? Okay, here I go. Where was I working yet? Over here. There's another one. Now, notice, didn't get reinforced second time, right? They don't keep them on an FR1 schedule, right? They scale them up, they stretch the ratio, so they're not always going to get reinforced. They put them onto an intermittent schedule of reinforcement. During training, they start with the FR1, and then they gradually stretch up, okay? Because, I mean, you can get into satiation, right? They're just giving the rat a little bit of this banana smoothie protein drink here. But still, you don't want them to satiate and go, oh, my tummy hurts. I'm just going to scratch at anything, or I'm just going to lay down. Oh, I'm going to feel sick, right? So they stretch this out, okay? With landmines, here's...
Why is he your favorite band?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I more I belong the last which I have now and he which I can.
So very, very cool stuff here. Beautifully simple, elegant conditioning, and you know, one. I mean, their APOPO's focus is on landmines, tuberculosis right now. But I mean, they're pointing out, it's like, well, what else could you do with the rats, right? I mean, And so, in terms of their success with tuberculosis. Microscopy typically has about an 80% success rate in terms of detection. The rats are over 90%, so they're actually better than a human operator in that sense, with either false positives or false negatives. That's pretty damn good. What else could they detect early stages of cancer by smell, potentially? So, you know, there's certain cancers that are very difficult to detect without some very elaborate blood work, and even then it's not necessarily a given. But could there be perhaps a scent detection for them? So you go into the office, you get tested by having a rat sniff you. We may need to work on that a little bit because a lot of people's like, a lot of people don't like rats for some reason. I don't really understand that. I think they're quite adorable. But regardless, samples. So what else could be done? I mean, we know that there's a use of, dogs and sometimes cats with epileptics for... predicting onsets of seizures. So what else can we do with these? So very interesting work. And I mean, the kind of the chap you saw there doing his explanation about the training of the rats, you could do this, right? You get through this course, you get some practical experience with working with the animals, you could be doing this, right? It's the kind of thing. It's not something that involves PhDs to be able to make a difference here. So you work with the animals, you train with them, you go out, you do some good work. So there's cool stuff, very cool stuff. You can also go and let me see if I can. Is this it? No.
train rats.
Yeah. You can adopt a rat.
Okay, so you can give money to adopt a rat. So there, you know,
Blossom. She's a sweet young rat. Oh, mind detector rat. Yeah. Elegant yet determined. Okay. So, we'll you know, we talked a little bit about advertising, right, and marketing. You know, what have they done here? They put Blossom next to some blossoms. You know, give a description of Blossom. You know, maybe, aww, right? Okay, likes, you know, making nests out of wood chips, designer harnesses for field training. It's like, oh, what a special rat. You know, there's Cheeky, Mojo, likes romantic comedies. Who knew? Nala. Okay. So, anyways, yes, you can go adopt a rat. Legions has been there's a TED talk out there where he talks about this, so you can go find that as well. Anyways, very nice demonstration of what you can do with real world philanthropy with rodents. Okay. So let's switch from there and talk a little bit about what's called self-awareness. Self-awareness is actually a little bit of a difficult sort of term to pin down or define, even depending on what area of psychology you're in or whether you're even in psychology or not. People kind of define this in different ways. I mean, self-awareness, consciousness, are these the same thing? In behavioral psychology, we define self-awareness very simply as being able to observe your own behavior and then learn from that. So by observing your own behavior, does your future behavior change? Okay, so that's self-awareness. So you're aware of what you're doing. Practically speaking, how do we measure this? Could be by use of looking at whether subjects can demonstrate foresight, so based on past experience. Can they make successful predictions about how their behavior will affect them in the future? So foresight, planning. Also self-recognition. So based on past experience, can you actually recognize that this is you or whether something has changed in your appearance? And so various ways we can do this. But the basic idea here is that if we observe other things happening in the world, so experience, we have experience of what goes on. So if you observe behaviors that are occurring in others, this can be beneficial. Right? If you have learned that when your boss is in a snarly mood, you should probably not go ask for a raise, you know, that's okay. By observing what's happening with somebody else, it probably benefits you. The argument is here, then you could produce, you know, you could increase the reinforcement for yourself by being aware of your own behavior. Conversely, if you're perhaps not very aware of your own behavior, you may achieve some punishment, right? So if you wake up in a particularly gnarly, not particularly nice mood, this may not be the day to go in and talk to your boss as you end up telling him or her just exactly what you really think about them. You know, maybe it's just the day to phone in sick. Or, you know, just put the do not disturb sign on your door and just do your work, right? Okay, so you get reinforcement by watching others, presumably self-awareness could have a similar effect, could allow you to enact a bit more reinforcement directly yourself. So, okay, if you have some knowledge of self, benefits. By doing this, you can make predictions about future behavioral outcomes. Okay? You can generate better response patterns, and hopefully this will all work out well for you at the end of the day. Now, so again, foresight, planning, right? Being able to make predictions of what's going to happen in the future. And there's various ways we can do that. We can do all kinds of interesting things with I mean, you can talk to humans, ask them why did you do that. With the non-humans, you can't. But you can do interesting things like path planning. So you can allow a rat or a pigeon to go through a maze or something and determine, you know, based on various stimuli, whether you know, positive or negative things will happen. And will they adjust their route through the maze to avoid the unpleasant things and pick up beneficial things? So you can look for foresight and planning. You can look at tool use, so being able to construct tools to be able to do something. Many species of animals engage in tool use. most species of animals, their innate behavior patterns that produce the tool use, but certain of the primates will actually custom make tools. So chimpanzees, for example, will do this. Yep. Oh, the mirror, the self-recognition? Yeah, I'll come to that. So as I said, there's various ways you can do this, but I'm going to talk a little bit here about mirror self-recognition task. Developed by a guy called Gallup, so primatologist. This has been done with things other than chimps. In fact, it's now commonly used with children. But in terms of other non-humans, dolphins, elephants, a variety of other primates, this has been utilized. Here's what Gallup did. He would present chimpanzees in an enclosure with a mirror. Large mirror, like full-length mirror, made of something that the chimps couldn't break, so usually a metal-based mirror. So they can hit on it all day, throw things at it, and you can easily hose it off, and it's not going to get broken. Found that the chimpanzees go through stages. Initially, the chimps seem to assume the reflection in the mirror is another chimp. So are you looking at me? Are you looking at me? You must be looking at me because I'm the only one standing. Then you get into a rage confrontation because the other chimp keeps staring at him or her. And anyways, so it goes from that. Then eventually it seems to get into, do you want to hang out? Just sort of sit close to the mirror and like play, mime games. This, can you follow my hand? Do you do it as well? So they'll start playing little games with the mirror. And then eventually at some point, they start using the mirror to do things like grooming. So, like for example, if they get food stuck between their teeth and back, chimps can actually crack open their jaw a heck of a long way, actually quite large enough to stick their entire hand into their mouth and root around in there and like yank something. So crack their mouth open, up in the air, find the thing that's stuck in their teeth, pull it out, eat it again. This sort of thing. Well, hey, don't waste the food. Very pragmatic. They'll groom. They'll part their hair. It's just like, got a date tonight. Is this looking good? Maybe this way. That. So they'll do things that they parts of their body that they can't see. So. I can't see my shoulder, so they'll look in the mirror and reach back and do something with that, brush stuff off or whatnot. So eventually they get to that stage. Once they get to that stage, there's an age-related issue with this. None of Gallup's chimps have ever really demonstrated, or not just Gallup's, but nobody using Gallup's process here has ever demonstrated moving on to this last stage before the chimps are about 4 years of age. Okay, so there's a developmental process here as well. But once they get to this last stage, where they're using the mirror to look at parts of their body that they can't see just with their eyes, they take and tranquilize the chimp, and then go in and they paint a dot on the chimp. And they use a special dye. They use a dye that has no scent and has no tactile characteristics, so it doesn't like crinkle. It's not like you get some paint on your hand. It's like, oh, that's a crinkly or it feels rough. It's a completely non-detectable paint dot. And they'll paint it on like on an ear or someplace, middle of the forehead, someplace that the chimp can't see without the mirror. So the chimp wakes up from being tranked. Ooh, what happened? Kind of like perhaps some of you have woken up after a particularly wild night of partying. It's like, stumble into the bathroom, look at yourself in the mirror, and realize that your eyebrows are missing. And what the heck? What, you've not done that to your roommates? You're probably nicer than we were back in the 80s. But so goes over, looks at the mirror. And if they start stare at the mirror for a moment and go, they're rubbing at the spot they can only see in the mirror. It's like, okay, the chimp has a sense of what they look like, self-recognition. They know that yesterday they didn't have this spot in the middle of their head. Today they do. What the heck is that? Right? So that would be passing the mirror self-recognition. or, you know, what's that in my ear, sort of thing. So changing the appearance, can they recognize that? This indicates that they have some form of mental self-image, so self-awareness. This is, I think, the only behavior measurement technique that I know of that has gone from primatology into human developmental psychology as a test. Many of the tests that are done in terms of non-human primate development have been taken directly from developmental psychology and then just imported with slight modification into primatology to test and see what the chimps and monkeys and other apes can do. This is the only one I really know of that has gone the other way, developed first in the non-human primates and then has become quite commonly utilized in developmental psychology. What we find with children is you do the same sort of thing. You take a young child and you put them in front of the mirror, and initially, you know, they fall over and get back up and look at the mirror, and maybe they wonder about that thing in the mirror. Really young kids just pretty much totally ignore what's in the mirror. Then they start sort of like wondering if it's another kid, tapping on it, and then at some point they seem to get to the point where, again, they perhaps seem to recognize this as them, at which point, you know, you tranquilize the child. Oh, Cricky, that was a dangerous baby there. Oh, let's see what we got. Yeah, you know. No, you don't shoot them with a trank gun. You just club them until they're... You wait for them to be asleep, okay? So you wait for the kid to pass out, which young kids tend to do fairly regularly, and Q-tip and touch the dye on the ear or the head, and let them wake up, and same thing. Do they say, what the heck is that? You know, same deal. If they do, they have presumably a self-image, so self-awareness of, this is me, and that was not there before. What happened while I was unconscious? With human children, usually beyond 18 months, they can pass this test. As a chimps, usually after 4 years of age. Now, this becomes an interesting issue, right? I mean, we've said different people use self-awareness, and we're talking self-awareness, consciousness, these sorts of things. I mean, should we say that children younger than, like, you know, 16, 18 months are not conscious? If we equate this the same way, does not having a sense of visual sense of self-representation equate to being unconscious entities? This is where these become interesting sort of questions and definitional questions. This is why, for the behavioral psychologist, again, the definition tends to be, for self-awareness, can you recognize something, a behavior that you do as self, and then use that to affect future behavior, because that sort of sidesteps the whole issue of, you know, does this mean that young kids just are completely unconscious little robot automatons, or something like that. So, excuse me. All right. So the self-recognition task. Skinner had a few things to say about this, as Skinner had a few things to say about just about everything. He said, look, we probably actually specifically train our children to be self-aware, to be self-observers through adult interactions and other children interacting with one another. He said, for example, the kinds of questions that we ask children will serve to reinforce self-observation, so being aware of things. So consider a shaping situation. I don't know how many of you have been around young kids, but, you know, at some point, you know, are you hungry? And, you know, two-year-olds often will go, no. Doesn't necessarily mean they mean no. It's just, no is a great word if you're somewhere around the age of two. Are you hungry? No. Okay, then I'll eat the cookie. You said no. Right. With my son, Kestrel, he's almost two now, so he's about 20 months old. It's like, drink? Drink? Yeah. You know, he's got this little sort of, yeah, sound. You know, initially it's like, drink? La da da. Ha. Ah. What's that? I don't know what a ha is, you know? Drink? Now, you know, after a little while of this, after, you know, a few weeks of this, it's like, yeah. You know, it's like, okay, we'll give you that drink. Thank you. You know, so, You got thank you pretty quickly. Figure that one out. So, you know, are you hungry? If you are hungry but you say no, you don't get the cookie or the snack or whatever it is. At which point, it sucks to be you. So it's like, am I hungry? I don't know. Am I hungry? Am I hungry? What is hunger? Yes! Okay, cookie. Sweet. Yeah. Nice. Or the ever popular, says the parent, what are you doing? Setting the rug on fire? What are you doing? Nothing. Uh-huh. Go do nothing outside. Yeah. Do we have any power tools? No. Yeah, but then what are you doing? Should you really give the true answer? Shaving the cat? Are you at least going to make clothes for the cat? Uh-huh. Carry on.
I'm allergic to cats. I had this suggestion for my wife that we could just shave her cat. Not all of it. We'll, like, from the sort of neck down. And I'd get the cat, like, suits of clothes. So... Yeah, well, you know, I was willing to give it a shot. Yeah, it probably is. It probably is. But you know, by observing my wife's response to my, what I thought, quite reasonable suggestion, you know, so observation of others, yeah. I've also learned not to trust everything my wife says. It's like we were spray gluing something, and I don't know what I was thinking. You're just like, we're spray gluing something. It's like, can I spray glue the cat? And it's like, yeah, you can spray. What? You didn't really do it, did you? You said yes. Just a bit. I'll wash the cat. Yeah, yeah. Washing cats is also not a good thing. Anyways, right. But my point. So observing others is beneficial. Observing yourself. Am I hungry? What am I doing? Is this something that Dad probably would not approve of? Could be. Yeah. Playing with my brother. Oh, okay. Wait. Are you playing? You know, volcano sacrifice. No. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. So you accurate responses
that lead to the desired outcome,
you're more likely to do those more. So Skinner's suggestion is that the kids get very good at self-awareness, self-recognition of self-behavior, observing self-behavior very quickly because they're specifically reinforced for it. And he said this may be why many of the non-humans are perhaps not terribly good at this. They just don't have anyone specifically... providing that kind of reinforcement. With respect to the question of as we've done with other animals, as I said, it has been. But for a long time, there was no evidence that, so this would work in chimps, but there was no evidence that it would work in, for example, gorillas for years. The problem with gorillas is if you make direct eye contact with another gorilla, it's generally a threat display. So the gorillas would see the mirror and just kind of like sit sideways to the mirror. Sometimes occasionally look over at it, but they wouldn't actually, because if they actually stared at the gorilla in the mirror, that would be an aggressive sort of thing. So they wouldn't do that. And so they don't actually look at their image very much. So they, it's like, all right, okay. Some tribe of dolphins. The problem there, of course, is, you know, it's really tough for a dolphin to turn its head around and look at its fin. So they had to come up with camera systems, video cameras with multiple televisions, screens that could show all the parts of the dolphin at once. And then what would happen is you paint a dot on the dolphin's fin. Yeah, the dolphin will swim backwards and forwards in front of the camera and look at the various parts of its body in the various TVs and can seem to pass this. Monkeys, various species of monkeys seem to be just completely baffled by mirrors. But it seems that perhaps about 6 or 7 years ago, there was a report of macaques finally passing this. It's just that they had to live with the mirror for something like 8 or 9 years before they could get through it. So very, very developmentally delayed. Well, like I said, I mean, with humans, you know, about 18 months, chimpanzees, usually not until they're at least 4 years of age. So the monkeys, once you go down to the monkeys, seems to be a much longer process. We're not sure how long it would take with the human band called the monkeys. It's never been tested. Let's move on. Self-control. Okay. Well, we talked about choice today. Self-control is essentially an aspect of choice. Now, the technical way of describing this is, will you forego a small immediate reinforcer for a delayed but larger reinforcer? So can you say, no, I'm not going to have this little thing right now because by doing so, I will get a larger thing later. Okay, so that's the sort of technical definition of self-control. This is not easy. Adults, children, non-humans often seem to suck at this. Matter of fact, for a very long time, it was assumed that non-humans could not exercise self-control at all. If you gave pigeons an opportunity, so you can either respond right now on this lever and get this little pile of birdseed, or if you press this lever and are willing to wait for 30 seconds, you can get a larger amount of birdseed. Immediate. It's like, pigeons have no self-control. There you go. May not surprise some people. You know, I see a car, I have to poop on it. Turns out, actually, non-human animals can exercise incredible self-control under real-world naturalistic situations. Hummingbirds, for example. Hummingbirds are like nature's little helicopters. They basically drink sugar, okay? There's like, I mean, you know, give them Red Bull. That's probably what would work great for hummingbirds. They burn calories like nobody's business. To stay hovering is really energetically expensive. So what they're doing is hummingbirds go to flowers and they suck the nectar out of them, but basically they are drinking sugar. Okay, that's what they do. Now, hummingbirds keep, they're called trap lines after the human concept of trapping animals and how the trapper calls them trap to trap to trap to trap in a pattern. Hummingbirds keep flower, quote-unquote, trap lines. That is, they will go from a flower to another flower to another flower. They keep a series of flowers in their territory, and they will go there and drink nectar from them. Now, once you have drunk all the nectar in a flower, the flower will eventually replenish the nectar. So more nectar will fill up, but this takes time. Okay? It's a benefit to the flower, right? The hummingbird comes, sticks its beak in there, gets some of the pollen on its beak and facial feathers, goes to another flower, drops the pollen off, so you get cross-fertilization, so yay, everybody wins. But if the hummingbird comes back to a flower too soon, the nectar hasn't replenished enough, so the energy it takes the hummingbird to fly back to that flower may be more than it gets from the nectar that's available at that flower. In other words, you've just spent more energy than you took in. If that happens, you know, that hummingbird's going down. So hummingbirds, you know, have to exercise self-control. If they go back too soon, they will not get enough nectar, enough energy to make the trip worthwhile. But this becomes even more complicated. Because just because these flowers are within a hummingbird's territory, those same flowers may be in an overlapping territory from another hummingbird. So you have to wait long enough so that the nectar replenishes. But the longer you wait, the more likely it is another hummingbird has gotten there first. Tricky. How soon do you go back? Too soon, you won't get enough to make it worthwhile. Too long, somebody else might have gotten all of it first. You give this assignment to people, and it just blows their mind, right? People suck at this. It's like, can I club the other person to death? No. I'll go now. Are you sure? I don't know. Maybe I should wait. Are you sure? Hummingbirds are great at this. They evolved to do it. They have amazing self-control in this particular area, right? They have terrible self-control with credit cards. I mean, they're just like buying, like I said, Jolt Cola and stuff online. It's terrible. Yeah?
Is that because, like, everything's become more accessible to us, so we've lost our self-control that we don't have to?
Excellent question.
Or is it, did we evolve that way, or were we like that before?
Well, that's a good question. Have we lost our self-control because everything is so accessible to us? No, probably most of us never, you know, historically have had a certain amount of poor self-control for some things than others. When you look at, say, resources, we can look paleoanthropologically back at, say, South Pacific islands, and we can see how, Topekia, for example. Topekia is a little island in the South Pacific, about 100 square kilometers of size, and people got there about 3,000 years ago. Started out having 6 different species of birds, lots of shellfish, fish, various nut trees, food plants, fruit trees on the island. About 800 years after arriving, people had pretty much eliminated all of the species of birds. They ate them all to such levels. I mean, you might say, if we can only exercise self-control and not eat all of this, not overhunt our resources, then we will have birds to eat forever. But they failed at that one. An interesting thing is about 600 years ago, the peoples of Topekia, now at about 3,000 people, which is sort of the carrying capacity of the island, made a very conscious decision to kill all of the pigs. So about 1,000 years ago, pigs were brought in, but as a group, and this is still told in the oral traditions. So about, what did I say? It was around 1600, actually. Sorry, it was about 1600, about 400 years ago. And they have stories of this. And what happened was, everyone talked about it, got together, and said, "We're killing all the pigs," because the pigs were tearing up their gardens and were competing with food. It takes 10 pounds of vegetables to produce 1 pound of pig that can be eaten. So these were a very bad resource. So in that case, they did exercise self-control and got rid of the pigs. So yeah, you can learn. This is the thing. You can learn self-control. The peoples of Topekia learned over years, like, we used to have birds. Now we don't. We can't eat that. So you can acquire self-control. You can get better at it. But it's generally not easy. There's things you can do to make it easier on yourself. We'll talk about some of that, actually, right now. So what's one way that you can assist your self-control? Physical restraint. So actually prevent a behavior from occurring. Gorillas. You should probably never play... Well, pros and cons. I mean, if you play poker with a gorilla, the one thing with gorillas is they can't control their facial expressions. If they're excited, they got this stupid grin. It's called play face. In the anthropological literature, primatology, it's called play face. So if they're excited about something, they're grinning like that. So, you know, if you're playing poker with a gorilla and, you know, you suddenly see it just fold, right? So there's the plus side. The downside is, you know, at clocking into 800 pounds, if you win, they can just, like, bludgeon the bejesus out of you. So pros and cons. So gorilla play face. Gorillas cannot disguise their facial, they can't bluff, right? Not lack the muscular control to not smile. So it's a scene. So young female gorillas will mess with young male gorillas. So, you know, the female gorilla will look over at the young male gorilla. She's got a grin on her face. The young male gorilla gets very excited about this, comes running over. Now, the female gorilla does this. Still there. His eyes still there. Puts the hands up over her lower face. The male stops suddenly. Slumps away, dejected. Takes her hands back down, still grinning. Looks up, sees, gets very excited again. Puts them up. Okay? No. It's messing with the boys. Hiding play face. In the literature, it's called hiding play face. You do that. And the gorilla seemed to interpret it like there's nothing there. It's the same way that we bluff. Okay? So physical restraint. They can't actually keep themselves from grinning, so they just cover it up. Seems a bit bizarre from our point of view, but it works for gorillas. You know, if you've got a little problem, you're worried about your kid getting into your liquor cabinet while you're away for the week, you know, lock up the liquor cabinet, or better yet, just drink it all before you leave. Credit cards. If you've got a little problem spending too much with your credit cards, cut them up. I don't want to cut my credit card. Cut them up. If you don't got your credit card, you can't use it, can you?
No.
But what if I need it? Is that how you got in debt?
Mm-hmm.
No. Right? Give it to somebody else to hang on to. Right? Cut it up. You can always, if I can order a new one, yeah, it'll take a while for it to get to you. Cut that one up and order a new one. Pretty soon the credit card company is going to be asking, what's going on? We've had to send you 12 new credit cards in the last 8 months. Okay. Physical restraint.
So try to prevent yourself from doing it.
Distancing. Behaviors are more likely to occur in specific environments. Right. Think about this. Discriminative stimuli. In the presence of the discriminative stimulus, if you make this response, here's this outcome. In the presence of the red light, if you press the lever, you will get a peanut. If there's no red light and you press the lever, nothing happens. Okay. If you avoid the environment, so the environments can be a discriminative stimulus. In the presence of this environment, if I do this, I will get this. In the presence of the chocolate fudge shop, if I buy chocolate fudge, I can eat it. I must cut down my fudge intake. Don't go to the chocolate fudge shop, right? Go to the rice cracker shop. Hi, I'd like 2 pounds of chocolate fudge. We don't have that. I can give you 14 pounds of rice crackers for the same price.
Mm.
Okay. Right? Be someplace else. Smokers. Smokers that want to quit. Right? Used to be you could smoke in universities if you were a professor. The cool professors would let their students smoke as well in class. I remember younger watching instructors smoke in class. I actually watched once one of my profs burn a hole through a screen, pointing at something over here at this cigarette. And someone's like, oh, no, here, the Visigoths invade Rome. It's like, ah. Rome burns, as it turns out. So, yeah. But, you know, as time has gone on, you know, smoke in as many places as you used to be able to for various reasons, whether that's good or bad, social issue. But if you've got smokers who are trying to quit, so I mean, walk around campus. People can no longer smoke inside the building. So you walk around campus, maybe you're a smoker, maybe you see smokers. Smokers congregate places, right? They take the break, they go out, they smoke. Okay, fine. Not judging them. But if you're trying to quit, don't go to the places where you used to smoke. Why? Because you have learned, what is this place? This is a smoking place. What should I do here? I should smoke. Go someplace else where you don't smoke. Right? Don't get your Tim Hortons coffee and go outside in front of the building, because that's where you're going to smoke. Take your Tim Hortons coffee, stay inside cabins and drink your coffee. You're not allowed to smoke there. Used to be able to smoke in cab. None of you will remember this, but they've redone cab with nice furniture and stuff, and floors. Up to the 90s, there was like some old ratty carpet there with lots of holes in it from cigarettes, right? So holes frequently in the carpet, so you used to be able to smoke in cab. Okay, so go someplace else. Distancing. Distraction. Engage in some behavior that's incompatible with the undesired behavior. So, DRI. Do something else that makes it incompatible. You want to eat chocolate cake? Go for a walk. Right? It's hard to eat cake in your kitchen if you're walking. This becomes problematic if your walk takes you past, you know, the death by chocolate shop. So you have to work on that one a little bit. Okay, so distraction, do something else that makes it incompatible. Right? Kids, I'm hungry. No, you're just bored. Go outside and play. Okay. It'll take your mind off it. Right? It's the annoying thing that parents say. It'll take your mind off it. But it's actually, I mean, it's distraction. You get doing something else, you don't think about it as much. Man, I'm talking about food and I'm hungry. Well, I'll distract myself by talking about deprivation and satiation. Okay. Well, that's actually still sort of related. You can use this to avoid excesses, going to an excess. So, for example, to avoid overeating at a party, eat a small meal before you go. Have a snack before you go. You will partially satiate. Okay? So you won't be as hungry when you get there. Now, this is the old saying, quite true, you know. Don't go grocery shopping when you're hungry. Right? Because what are you doing? It's like, ooh, that chicken's already cooked. I should buy one of those. Right. Seriously, they should put the chickens in the checkout line, okay? Safeway should just, like, stick them right there. Well, spit barbecue. Say, that looks great. I'm taking that. All the people that are hungry. You know, the candy bars. Right? Why are all the candy bars there at the checkout? The Pops, all those there right at the checkout. People suddenly thinking, man, I'm hungry. I bought all this food, but I have to go cook it. That's going to take some time. I'm hungry now. I'm buying this. Instant gratification. Okay. So partial satiation. Partially satiated. Now, keep in mind, you need to pick the appropriate thing for the behavior. I really want my heroin. You know what? I'm just going to shoot up a little bit before I go. No, wrong decision. Okay. Pick a different way. Assistance. Get some help. Inform others of what you're trying to do. You know, it's kind of a trendy term, but enablers. Your friends are often enablers of your behavior, right? If you smoke, odds are you know other people that smoke, you get together, you smoke. You don't mind if your friends smoke in your house, they don't mind if you smoke in their house, okay? So, look, tell people, it's like, look, sorry, I'm trying to quit smoking. Why? I just am, okay? All right, fine. All right. Look, I need you, okay? When I'm around, please don't smoke in front of me. Go someplace else and smoke, just please don't do it. Okay, or I'm trying to save money, okay? Instead of going out for big expensive dinners, it's like, oh, okay, why don't we just do potluck? Come on over and do potluck. It's like, okay, great. Get people to help you. Changes the environment. Big one, behavioral monitoring. If you're trying to implement self-control, if you're trying to change some behaviors, keep track of what you're doing. Get a notebook, get some graph paper, put things up where you're going to see them. Put it up on the fridge, put it up on the bathroom, tape it up on the wall in the bathroom, you know, so you see it first thing in the morning, what you're trying to accomplish. If things are out of sight, they will be out of mind. Visible indicators of your behavior help you keep track of it. One of the huge problems with people spending money is now, you know, we use our little debit cards, right? Used to be you had to go to the bank and take money out for the weekend. Now you've always got money. And it's not even really physical money because, you know, how many of you actually know right now exactly what you've got in your bank account? Exactly. Plus or minus a bit, right? It's hard to keep track. If you've actually say, this is my budget for the week, you know, $150. You put the $150 in your wallet, beginning of the week. Every time you open it, it's like, holy smokes, where did it go? Oh, yeah, that's where it went. I've only got $70 left, and it's only Tuesday. Okay? So keep it in sight. Study done with dieters in a room. What they really wanted to find out was self-control. So person gets to the room, says, oh, the researcher is just with another participant. You just sit here. Wait for a few minutes. He'll be right with you. A little bowl of candy in the room next to them. Okay. In the first case, the dieter can just sit there in the room, eat some candy, and nowhere to throw the wrappers, but just leaves them kind of on the table. Second case, they put a garbage can there. Under the little side table. Eat the candy, take the wrapper, throw it out of sight. What do they find? The dieters are able to throw their little, I call them candy skins, you know, out, ate more candy. The dieters that had to look at their candy skins, the candy wrappers, accusatorily lying there saying, you just ate six of us, ate less. Keep a record. If you want to increase the amount of time you spend studying, track it. Okay, combine it with reinforcement. Set goals, right? If I do this much studying this week, I get, yay, this thing. If I don't, I don't. How do you know if you've reached it? Keep track. Okay. So, behavioral monitoring. And that's where we'll end for the day. Okay, if I don't have your third assignment, please bring that on up to me.